Good morning. My name is Rita Schulte. This is the first hour of Focus 580, and I'm setting in here this morning for David Inge, who's away today. And our guest this morning is Kevin Waspy, who is with the Department of Finance here at the University of Illinois. And today we're going to be talking business. Basically, we're going to be talking personal finance. What's on your mind about the current trends in what we're looking at in the markets, how it affects you here in Central Illinois, and what you'd like to do with your portfolio. I'd like to say thank you this morning to our producer, Harriet Williamson, and to our technical director, Henry Frain, for making this possible and for helping us get your calls on the air. When you call 217-333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Rita. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited because this is always one of the easiest shows to do because the phones just light up because everybody's interested in what's going on. Everybody's got a whole lot more. Yesterday they were talking all over NPR about skin in the game. They were asking which is a relatively grisly image and conjures up, you know, the Merchant of Venice just a little bit. But it was definitely a topic of buzzword yesterday on the news all day long. We were looking just the other day at the couch potato portfolio, which has returned reasonably well, all things considered.
Well, the portfolio that Dave Sino usually discusses when he's here with David Inge, like the market, has rebounded pretty nicely. It's encouraging to see that, at least for the moment, we're not seeing a continual decline mm-hmm. in asset prices. We're not seeing a continual gain in pain, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, keep your fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, seriously. Well, I noticed this morning the market was real twitchy, it looked like, this morning. When I checked the front page of the Wall Street Journal with its nice little graph, it looked like a very nervous EKG going on there.
Markets have been extremely nervous, not only U.S. stock markets, but most markets throughout the world, whether it's equities, bonds, currencies. There's a lot of heightened anxiety as recovery in prices and some first signs of recovery, not only in the U.S. economy, but some of the economies of countries in Europe have begun to appear. So I suppose it's not unusual to see that kind of nervousness come in as, you know, prices have risen pretty dramatically from their lows.
Mm-hmm. One of the top stories a couple of days ago was the gentleman who predicted the black swan, this bubble that was going on, was also still talking about inflation being a serious threat on the horizon.
That's become much more of a topic at hand. It has become, I think, in some cases, over-discussed. We could get into, a favorite theme of mine, if you want to call it that, or mm-hmm. an outlook moving, you know, long term. But certainly with the rise in interest rates that we've seen, with the huge supply of Treasury securities coming mm-hmm. to the marketplace to finance all of the deficit spending that this country and most developed nations are doing, the thought of higher interest rates and higher inflation is certainly becoming more topical.
Mm-hmm. And somebody had suggested that the Treasury was just trying to float us out by printing more money.
Well, I won't disagree with the first part of the statement. I would say that we could probably debate the second part of the mm-hmm. statement. Printing more money is obviously a very emotional topic with most mm-hmm. people who have a sense of money itself. What the Treasury has been doing is finance a huge deficit. The issuance of Treasury bills, notes, and bonds has been at record levels. Yesterday afternoon, or at noon our time, the Treasury announced that next week they're selling $102 billion worth of new issues. And quite frankly, when you look at it over the scope of the deficit at hand, through the end of this year, I mean, you could basically do a little arithmetic mm-hmm. and say that the Treasury is going to have to sell roughly $15 billion worth of securities every day between now and the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Now, they obviously won't do that every day, But that gives us some sense of the magnitude of the shortfall between what is being spent and what is being taken in tax receipts.
Are Americans starting to do what they ask us to do for years and save more, or are we just not spending?
That's a fundamental that is definitely a process and change, I think, long term. It only makes sense that we should probably expect to see our population become more thrifty. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to become as perhaps Japan would be and save anywhere near as much of our income as that culture does traditionally. But it only makes sense to me when I look at the demographics. If we think of 84 million baby boomers in a 320 million population of the country, we are all moving into that stage of our lives where consumption probably has peaked. Income potential has probably peaked. A standard of living has probably peaked. And it makes sense then that we would be spending less and therefore saving a little bit more. So I think the days of 2005, maybe even 2006, where we had negative savings rates in the national numbers, are a thing behind us. And that's good long term, but it does mean that a recovery based on a consumer-led spending spree, in my opinion, is just not in the cards.
Are we manufacturing enough here in the United States to help support a good recovery?
I don't think so, but manufacturing in this country has been on a stiff decline for many years. I think that's one of the problems that we probably need to address moving forward. I just don't I don't share some of the methodologies that are being used presently in ways that are attempts to help manufacturing. I've got some radical thoughts, and you know, I mean, I would say that as radical as my thoughts are, what's going on right now is just mind-boggling. It's beyond radical. I can't even come up with a word to describe it.
Scary.
That's a good word. Good start.
Good start. Well, that was Einstein's, they were talking about the other day, Einstein's spooky logic out there. I want to remind you, the number to call is 217-333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. And unless we have all depressed you into non-action, let's talk a little bit about the couch potato portfolio and what's in there. It looks to me like everything was up except U.S. REITs. The real estate market is still a little shaky, maybe?
I would say the real estate market is probably going to be one of the last markets to turn around, experience a rebound, however you want to call it. It was certainly one of the markets that was more overinflated, and it was probably going to be a case of needing to take more time to come down to a level of sane valuation. So I think it's going to continue to be a lagging asset category.
And these, for those of us who are a little unfamiliar with what it all is comprised in some of these securities, are they existing buildings, real, just general real estate, housing tracts, apartments?
Yeah, that's a great question. A REIT, a real estate investment trust, can run so many different places in so many different ways. They can be focused. They can be commercial real estate like office buildings. They can be warehouse space and focused in that area. They can be shopping centers, strip malls, retail outlets, if you want to just use a broad category. They can be housing, whether it's condominium type housing where we don't see the residents owning the property, but a 1-to-4 family type structure to megaplexes where there's 300-400 apartments. So, I mean, in terms of the actual type of property that a real estate investment trust could own, they can run the gamut from all property out there and be broadly diversified across all of them or focused in any one or two areas.
Okay. Is there any sense that some of those some of those different sectors are slowing some of their inventory a little bit to wait on increasing their building and trying to get occupancy going?
Some of the areas that in the monthly housing starts numbers that have come out that have shown some signs of pickup have been in the 1 to 4 family category. There have been more housing starts in that category. That might reflect a little bit of perhaps people moving out of a single family dwelling that might be going through foreclosure. They obviously need a place to live. And a demand for something like duplexes, fourplexes, living in one of those is probably beginning to see a little bit of an uptick.
Well, we have our first caller on line number one. Hello, caller, are you there?
Yes.
Great. What's your question?
If I haven't already missed it, I am interested in hearing the guest's opinions or his radical opinions about the current way that we're dealing with manufacturing base. And in his opinion, what is a more sensible approach to manufacturing in the United States?
Great. Well, let me drop the bomb.
I'm gonna listen to the radio.
Okay, thank you, caller.
I'll go ahead and drop the bomb then. The approach that's been taken to date has been subsidizing industries. We obviously see that with a government-led process of taking Chrysler and General Motors both into bankruptcy, marrying parts of Chrysler off with Fiat, allowing certain aspects of the current capital structure to suffer because of that, and what would I say is an artificial design in doing all of it. I'll drop my bomb, and I'll just say one thing that I would say is a radical but probably more fundamentally sound approach would be, instead of picking winners and losers, is to level the playing field. And here's what I mean. Let's eliminate corporate income tax. Let's just do away with it. If we had no corporate income tax, the first reaction many would have would be, oh, well, you're just giving money away to corporations. And I want you to stop and think about that for just a minute. If you buy something, a good or a service, from an incorporated entity, don't you assume that part of the cost structure of what you're buying is the income tax that corporation has to pay? In other words, who pays corporate income taxes?
Basically, I do.
It's my belief that the consumer pays corporate income taxes. So taking a situation that we have at present, where we are a country among all developed nations that has one of the highest rates of corporate income tax, one way to spur investment by corporations in doing business in this country, manufacturing goods, providing services, and not outsourcing, would be to eliminate that 35% tax on their profits. Just do away with it. It's, again, controversial because many people just look at the surface and say, all you're doing is giving a big break to corporations. Some people go to the next line and then they say, well, what are you going to do to make up for all of the missed taxes that the federal government wouldn't collect from that source? And I would suggest that that activity is viewing the process in a static situation. You're assuming that the economy will not grow, that corporations will not relocate to the United States to do business, and that the level of business activity will be unchanged. And if that is indeed the case, then tax receipts will fall further. The deficit will expand more. The beauty in eliminating this tax is to entice more corporations to do business here, more manufacturing to be located here, more jobs to be created here, more people employed, making more income, paying more taxes. That's growth in the economy. And I think if we go back over any long-term period, the past 200 years, and look at the way, the single biggest way tax receipts grow, it is not from raising tax rates. It is instead from seeing growth in economic activity. That's the way things work.
With that help, we have family in on the East Coast, and when we drive out there, we go town to town to town to town, and there's all this capacity that's not being used in factories. And some of these, of course, are at the point where they would need such retooling that it will be less costly to take them down or turn them into lofts if they're architecturally interesting. And that might even be a source of you know, some generating of revenue.
Sure.
But would that assist some of these old line towns, these old manufacturing towns, in encouraging them to, you know, buff and polish a little bit on some of those things and maybe solicit some use of their excess capacity sitting around?
Well, I think that's a good point, and this is a little bit like a snowball. Mm-hmm. If we could imagine something like that happening, the first thing corporations would try to do is identify areas that would be able to provide them with the necessary inputs so that they could locate there. Obviously, a physical facility is a part of a process in manufacturing, but there's also a labor force. Does the area still have a skilled labor force that could be the active integer in making that corporation want to relocate to that area? And if the answer is yes, then I think, again, when you find necessary conditions come together, it's a little bit like baking a cake. If you have all of the right ingredients, unless you really do something horrible with your oven, the cake usually turns out quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. And are there investment opportunities if you are a pretty savvy person looking for a way to help invest in something along those lines?
Well, in terms
of making the assumption that we were able to, if not completely eliminate this tax, which would have a lot of people squeaking about the element of fairness, bring it down to the point where it's virtually negligible.
If you could imagine a situation where that scenario were put in place, then I think you could probably expect to see an increase in heavy industry manufacturing. Mm-hmm. You'd certainly find a much more competitive environment that would allow things like very capital-intensive industries to be able to compete globally, whereas now the margin is tilted in favor of finding an area that has low labor costs because all of the other costs are so much higher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That sort of answers the caller's question about the bomb that drops. That's not the first time I've heard that as a possibility for encouraging or enticing industry back into the United States, or even encouraging foreign direct investment to have somebody come in, and if U.S. firms don't, maybe
exactly.
Foreign firms coming in.
We've been huge beneficiaries, and we've also paid the price for having much of our financial investment being done by foreigners. In other words, the purchase of paper assets has been basically what has financed the growth that we've seen. That's not going to go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And to find direct investment in property, plant, equipment, in things like employing people at good living wages, those are the kinds of things that are going to carry us for the next 50 or 100 years, because we can't expect foreign national banks to always be buying our paper.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have another call on line number 2 from Savoy. Hello. Are you there, caller?
Hello?
Hi. Yes. What's your question?
Hi, are you getting me all right?
Yes, we are.
I've got a simple question.
Okay.
If the corporations are paying... are charging consumers for the income, federal income tax that they pay, and if that income tax is abolished, I would think it would be only fair that the corporations reduce the price of whatever they're selling by the amount of corporate income tax that they had been charging the consumer for. Will that happen? And if it's not likely to happen, how can we make it happen?
That's a great question. Will it be a penny for penny? I don't think so. Do you want it to be a penny for penny? Well, yeah, if you want a central controlled economy. If you want the Kremlin to dictate what profit margin a company is able to extract from providing a good or service, then I would purport to you we could go back to Moscow 25 years ago. You could walk into a store, you could find all kinds of things on the shelves that people didn't want and a shortage of things they did.
So you're saying that fairness on the part of these corporations would be communism?
Well, I would say dictating that the penny saved of corporate income tax not be paid, forcibly being pushed along in a reduction of the price of their goods and services would be a central statist economy. And again, we've seen the model in Moscow. I don't like it.
Would you go along with, you say, to the last penny? Would you go along with having them refund to the consumer, not to the last penny, perhaps 90%?
No. No, I wouldn't, because it's like being a little bit pregnant.
So what you're saying is that this is going to be a gift to corporations.
No, what I'm saying is it's going to allow the market forces to bring a benefit to both the corporations by having a higher profit margin and to consumers by having a lower price. The forces of supply and demand will bring into equilibrium a sharing of a benefit.
Well, you know, if the government were me to get, were to give me the same break on my income taxes, I would buy more of what these corporations are selling. Well, anyway, thank you for your answer.
Sure, you're welcome, and that's a great point. The reduction in personal income tax has that same stimulus effect for exactly the reason that you just mentioned. You're able to spend and save more with fewer of your income dollars being taxed away. That provides an economic incentive for manufacturers to produce more, to employ more. The result, again, is the economy grows. I don't think anyone will argue too strongly that higher tax rates do have a dampening impact on economic output. I mean, that's something that's really not too subject of a debate.
Mm-hmm. And as I would understand it, if a corporation would be incentivized to make its price go to where the consumer would buy the product, that if they're making something and their profit margin is so high that it's expensive, I'm not going to buy it. I will buy it from somebody who will give me a less costly piece.
Well, if we again believe that we're in a competitive marketplace, you know, manufacturer A and manufacturer B selling basically the same product compete for quantity of sales.
Mm.
How do they compete? One of the primary reasons, one of the primary methods they compete is price.
Okay.
If we assume quality of goods the same and availability the same, where's the consumer going to go? That's the nature of a competitive marketplace.
Okay. We have a call on 9 number 3 from Urbana. Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I missed out on the introduction of your guest, but it strikes me that he lives in a bipolar world where you either have a free market or if you have any regulation, you're headed right towards Moscow, you know, 1975. I'm sort of stunned. But back to his comment about the beauty of abolishing corporate income tax, you know, it strikes me that, you know, I think about that's a beautiful idea. But other ingredients in this cake he wants to build is that people want to have a livable wage. So why don't we abolish all of the minimum wage regulations in the U.S.? And another ingredient in the cake is it's expensive for corporations to meet health and safety things. So why don't we abolish OSHA? And another ingredient in the cake is it's expensive to make corporations protect the environment. So why don't we abolish the EPA and just let them all have at it? You know, this would just be a beautiful, beautiful world. I mean, this discussion has all the sophistication of a economics 101 textbook. Isn't there any nuance in this person's perspective?
Well, I've been
one last comment. The last point you made about high taxes stifling productivity. You just have to go look and ask the people living in northern European countries that have a much, much higher tax rate than we do about their miserable lives. They all have a lifestyle that most Americans would love to have. And this constant sort of anything that does anything to improve the quality of life is headed towards Kremlin-style socialism. It's just, that's an antiquated way of thinking. I can't believe that you're not more sophisticated than that.
Well, thank you for the call. I've prefaced, I guess, the idea to drop corporate income taxes by saying, let me drop the bomb. It obviously landed on you as ground zero. So, you know, I've got a pretty thick skin. I've been called dull and I've been called unsophisticated and many more things I can't mention on the air. But let me just put it this way. Just because we take an approach that incites you the way it has does not mean that we have to be silly. To do away with OSHA, to do away with the EPA, to give, how should we say, carte blanche to anybody who wants to do anything in an industrial sense just because we think it's good that there is no regulation. That's not a road that I'm walking down. Just like a road walking down saying, if I do X, then I end up in Moscow. You see, we're not just doing X. We're moving closer to Moscow because we've done A through Z, and we're starting over with double letters. What I'm suggesting is walking a different path. I'm not suggesting that we run down a slippery slope to an area that literally allows the economy to be run roughshod by a single motivator called profit potential. I am all in agreement that there are areas that need regulation. There are healthy, there are good regulations. Labor laws are not bad things. Laws that restrict things like pollution emissions, so on and so forth. These are not bad things. There is a very good, there is a very necessary and needed role for regulation in areas that a central government is good at regulating. It just doesn't need to reach as deep as it's beginning to reach.
I'd like to reintroduce our guest this morning is Kevin Wasby. He's with the University of Illinois Department of Finance. He's a lecturer on finance at the U of I. He's with us this evening to, or this morning to talk about finance, personal finance, and answer your questions. 217-333-9455 is the number to call. 800-222-9455 is our toll-free number, and we have a caller on line number 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
And what's your question, sir?
Yeah, I have a couple. Subsidies, you know, in other words, farm subsidies, all this kind of stuff. What's your feeling about that? I don't think that's fair competition, quite frankly.
I agree. I'm not going to make many friends with I'm not going to make many friends today with local farmers, but, you know, the production of agricultural goods in this country, and we could tick through the individual items, is a highly protected industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. But and then the other issue, I mean, again, I agree with you. I mean, you're making the proposal in terms of, you know, corporate taxes. I mean, that's the main your main thrust. What about your feeling about, you know, I think that business schools are probably, I taught in that area, particularly marketing and such. It was this drive to the bottom, you know, in terms of the lowest, you know, in other words, it had to do with labor. So you moved to, you know, one country and you did the manufacturing there. And then all of a sudden when the labor costs went up, then, you know, it's a drive to another country in terms of manufacturing. I mean, corporations made a lot of money in terms of cheap labor. I mean, these products come back, you know, in certain areas, and we're paying a fair price for them, you know, compared to what they pay for them. So what's your feeling about that?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. If you could,
but in terms of labor cost, in other words, driving to the bottom is the idea that it's you get the cheapest labor in these developing nations to manufacture these products, consumer products. And what happens is that all of a sudden when the labor costs start getting up to a certain degree, then corporations then they'll move the manufacturing to another country, you know.
Right. I agree with or I understand what you're saying there. All I'm wondering is if we need to broaden our view of the input costs of production. Labor is certainly one of the largest, if not the largest, depending upon the item. But it's not the sole input cost in any process of manufacture. When we do things, we, you know, one party as opposed to our country as opposed to some other country. When we do things that increase other costs of production, corporate income tax is one of them, we look to find the manufacturer need to consider all costs of input as a component of what they expect to get as a rate of return. If the only way they can accept or produce the acceptable rate of return is to look at the labor input cost because it's easier to locate the manufacturing somewhere else where there's cheaper labor, then that's the box we've pushed them into. Let's think about lowering another cost of input, that being their corporate income tax, and assuming that there would be less pressure on looking for cost of inputs from other things. I'm all about cost benefit. So back to the previous caller. You know, there's no one answer that is a silver bullet here. These things have to be examined. You have to think about unintended consequences. You have to put it into a multi-variable process. All I'm asking for is that open-mindedness as opposed to the ground zero reaction that so many people have to the thought of corporate income tax. The box that I see many manufacturers pushed into is to look to reduce the cost of labor. That loses the U.S. jobs.
And we have another call on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
I'm interested in the question of the multivariate environment because we seem to be ignoring some things. And part of it is to ask, that I'd like to ask is the question of tax policy.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of experience with tax abatement. Municipalities, localities have attempted that as a strategy for years and years, and there's reasonable data that suggests that it isn't effective, and that isn't the reason that manufacturers or businesses relocate. That's item one. I think the evidence is overwhelming that tax reduction is not the driving force. I don't want to cite a lot of studies because I'd like to make a couple more points. Secondly, corporations, like individuals, receive services that they often take for granted. And it seems to me that when you're looking at inputs, you need to also examine outputs. Governments, whether it's the federal government or the state or a locality that's assessing a tax, also provides a great range of services, and large businesses use those services more intensively than individuals. So if you expand that, for example, I think it's rather difficult to justify getting rid of corporate income taxes. So I'll stop there and listen to your reply.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Where do I begin? What other items in this multiple variable mix would you like to discuss?
And when we're thinking about this right now, I think it's extremely advantageous when we look at outsourcing and offshore locations. Outsourcing, we can put a lot of service activities. Other kinds of outsourcing we've seen through NAFTA and through the relocation. The computer industry is a powerful example of that, because I don't think there's any incentive that can bring back, that can address the disparity between paying somebody in India $250 a month to provide tech support versus paying somebody a living wage in this country. So I do think it's some of the argument that you've made in terms of what businesses' costs are in a global marketplace, and simply saying that I agree, I'm not going to accuse you of lacking nuance or sophistication, but I honestly cannot imagine how you can ignore the profoundly different costs, not only in terms of tax policy, because right now it's really advantageous for businesses in this country to locate their corporate headquarters out of the country and get away from, they're getting away from our taxes anyway. So dropping the corporate tax, again, I think I could go on and on about the pieces that I see, but one of my questions to you is, how do you get a frame that is so narrow and corporate without looking at the outputs from governments, the consequences of the asymmetric or the dissymmetries, if you will, the diseconomies that American businesses have to face, not the least of which is health insurance and benefits in retirement that most of the rest of the world has government pay for. Now, if we don't have corporate taxes, and they're not. I do not believe that corporations are currently paying their fair share. We're looking at a problem, and you're offering us a silver bullet.
No, I need to take exception there. I said quite clearly this is not a silver bullet. I'm asking for a little bit more open-mindedness in considering something. And again, at the start, I prefaced it as, let me drop the bomb. I've obviously been successful in creating conversation, which, quite frankly, I think is a starting point, a good starting point. In your analysis, let me observe that you've made an implicit assumption that the $250 worker in India provides the same quality of service as the person in this country at a living wage, in your words. Is that a given, or is that not open for debate too?
I'm not suggesting that the quality of service in India is substantial, substandard. Because I deal a lot with very, very capable technical support people not only in India, but in the Philippines and in Sri Lanka and Pakistan. And God knows, I think I've talked to people in Mexico as well. And I'm sure any place where you have a reasonable university system and decent high schools, you're going to have a very similar quality of service, but you will be able to obtain labor at an amazingly cheaper cost. Now, I've also asked young people if they are making enough money to live, and they say, well, as long as I live with my family, whatever. So, again, please, I'm questioning the frame that you're drawing around things. Perhaps it's too difficult in the kind of radio encounter that exists here to discuss further the number of variables that you would admit. But what I've suggested is that we're not allowing a very important piece is this labor question, and in all of its complexity. And there is no assumption on my part that people working in other parts of the world are providing something that's less than an American. I do know that their standard of living is less. And it may not be bad for them to make $250 a month.
Okay. Okay, let's forge on. And do you want to address some of that, Kevin, or move on? Okay, I think we get your point that there's multivariables here that we have to look at. And I'd like to get some input from the caller we have on line two in Champaign.
Hello.
Yes.
I tuned in late, so I have a two-part question. First, are you talking about sweeping, eliminating all corporate income taxes, or are you talking about reducing them? Second, who else is advocating this besides yourself? And actually, a third, what would the impact be on the federal and state budgets? That's my question.
First question again was,
are you
eliminating all corporate taxes, or merely reducing them, or for all corporations, eliminating them?
I dropped a bomb, so I started with eliminating. That's obviously gotten conversation going. So in the spirit of negotiating, let me say cut them in half.
Okay. For all corporations, startup companies, as well as huge multinational conglomerates.
Sure.
Okay. Who's advocating this besides you, Kevin?
I think if you read some of the publications of either the Cato Institute or some other, I would call them progressive think tanks, economic writings, you'd find that this is not my single idea. I can't take credit for this.
Okay. How do you think this would impact federal spending and state budgets, because it seems to me it would place a terrible burden on the ordinary citizens.
How would it do that?
How would it do that? Well, I don't see how, you know, if I'm making $50,000 a year and a corporation is making $50 million a year, they ought to be paying taxes. I don't see how we can survive on me paying taxes.
Well, back to one of the original statements that I made in this bomb, it's probably debatable, but I don't think we're going to find a lot of academic literature supporting the belief that corporations actually pay those income taxes. You and I as consumers are paying them. So,
well, I know that there's a lot of ways for them to get out of taxes, and they can also pay.
No, it has nothing to do with getting out of.
You mean it's nothing to do with loopholes?
No. Now let me think of something like a lemonade stand. If you set up a lemonade stand and 35 cents of every dollar of your profit after you account for the cost of lemonade is going to be taken away by your big brother, but the kid across the street doesn't have a big brother, so he can set up a lemonade stand and not have that 35% of profit burden. Do you think he can sell his lemonade for a cheaper price?
Oh, well, I'd have to...
No, come on, play with me.
I'm not really into that. Okay. Stand example. Everybody has to cover their costs. You know, that's a given. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to stay in business very long. But, you know, I don't think corporations would be good citizens if they didn't pay taxes.
Well, we all love to hate corporations. They're those...
It's got nothing to do with hating corporations.
Well, they're those faceless entities that, rape and pillage our earth. That's an unhealthy approach.
As far as corporate guidance, it could be provided by think tanks, that some oversight so that we wouldn't have the abuses that we've seen in just in the past few years.
Well, as we're discussing these things, I only think it's good to have a healthy discussion in a way that allows us to think outside of what I would say is a narrow approach. God knows we've taken some very drastic actions in one direction. I think at the expense of consideration of other possible tools.
Okay, thanks.
Because you've got an interesting chart up there.
Global
GDP.
The chart that I pulled up is 2006 World Book Facts. It shows the GDP, global GDP by country. This goes back to 2006, so I apologize for not finding something more timely. With roughly $13 trillion, the U.S. GDP, back to one of the previous caller statements about northern European countries and the circumstance of their level of taxes, the circumstance of their condition of lifestyle, and the envy we all of us Americans have of their system, of their lifestyle. I would say, quite frankly, I have no desire to move to Sweden. Now, I know I'm radical, but I believe that caller called me from Urbana. And obviously he hasn't moved to Sweden either. So I look at the chart and I see Sweden's GDP at roughly $400 billion. And what I'm saying is, you know, there are such huge differences in so many different ways between a country like Sweden or Norway and the United States or China. You know, we've got to think about those kinds of things. It's not just a single point comparison that can be made. Is Sweden ever going to be an industrial powerhouse in the world economy? I don't think so. But it's not just because of their tax structure. And in the same vein, because they'll never be a world power in the global GDP, they can have that type of tax structure. They can have that type of quasi-socialist central planning because their population is so small, because their landmass is so small, because that's a huge difference.
One of the things that had occurred to me while you were speaking with the last caller is in the theoretical frame that we're drawing without a corporate income tax, the assumption is that we have more jobs. So it's not just one $50,000 or $30,000 or $100,000 worker that's lifting the load. It would be any additional folks that would be added onto payrolls and have income structure and would be working toward creating community there for themselves in their towns or in their cities or states, and then drawing against the federal government's resources as they're sharing that for national type things, defense, interstates, decent power grid that would interconnect everything, the sort of things that interstate commerce would depend upon. So it's not just General Motors, or just pick another example. It's not just Procter & Gamble and the Schulte family traveling circus trying to float this country. It's our whole neighborhood and everything that, you know, so there's that economy of scale going on there too, theoretically.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing me back to that. That's a central issue, a central point that I would say is the foundation of what I'm saying. Our future in terms of a higher standard of living, a better possibility of a living wage, more people having a higher potential of achieving that minimum wage, that more than minimum wage, that living standard that we all aspire to, is based on a growth in the economy. It is not based on a shrinking economy. When we all fight over a shrinking pie, it brings out the result of getting smaller pieces for all. It's time to begin to think about ways to help grow the pie to benefit all.
Mm-hmm. And when you said something, it started a question in my head, and I got another gray hair, and it just killed that brain cell. So I'm going to go to caller number 3 in Urbana. Okay, caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'd actually like to move maybe a little bit away from the guest's ideas about tax go-to regulation. I have friends from China. Actually, they were there with a woman who was actually a babysitter for our son when he was quite young, and she was getting an international law degree from U of I, and her husband worked in Caterpillar. And they eventually moved back to China, and they lasted a couple of years. They came back again. They moved back. They wanted to be back in the United States. And one of the main reasons why they wanted to be back in the United States was because of regulation. That the gentleman who had worked for Caterpillar, Chinese man, went back to the People's Republic, communist country, and he said there was no regulation, and he missed it. He said that they would go into the grocery store, and he said, you have no idea what it's like, he says. You don't know how lucky you are, you Americans. You go into a grocery store, and you don't have to worry all the time that you're there and after you make your purchases whether you might have bought something that would kill you or make you ill or your child ill. He said, when you do that in China, because there is no regulation, he says, you just don't know, but you are constantly worried that the thing that you're buying might actually be safe or not.
Agreed. All I would have to say is, back to a previous statement, there are very, very, very good examples of places where regulation is needed, and that's a classic.
Okay, I'd like to thank our callers this morning. We've run out of time. And do you have some parting thoughts? We never got past the REITs, but it was fun. It's always fun to talk to.
Thanks, Rita.
To get a real serious, it's like a family table at dinner. You know, you just like yell at each other and maybe you feel good when it's done, but somebody's shared some ideas, invented a little passion.
Well, hopefully I didn't hurt any feelings, but again, I think an important integer in moving forward is to get people engaged and thinking and exploring and considering alternatives.
And with that, we'd like to thank our guest, Kevin Waspy, from the University of Illinois Department of Finance, College of Business, for stepping in today and talking with us. And I'd like to thank you also for the stimulating discussion. It's always fun when you're a guest host to have phone calls, even if you miss the topic altogether and started down some other path. So we'd like to thank you very much, and we're going into the rest of the day, and we'd like to say thank you to Henry Frayne and to Harriet Williamson.